100 years ago, the Representation of the People Act was passed, which gave some women the right to vote in UK general elections for the very first time. The focus on early female suffrage campaigners in the UK tends to centre on the actions of the suffragettes in the capital. But the path to the voting rights we enjoy today has a much more complicated story. It was a national movement, fought by women and men of all classes, people of all ages and in locations right across the UK. People who lived and worked at places now in the care of the National Trust were also involved and influential throughout the campaign. This year, right across the Trust, properties are delving into their archives for the stories of people who took part in or bore witness to these momentous events. In this five-part series, you'll hear from house stewards, curators, volunteers and experts in a unique account of how Trust, people and places helped to bring about the freedoms that we enjoy today. For the full story, please do listen from episode one. Previously on Women and Power, we heard how radical thinking on the streets of Manchester laid the foundations for the suffragist moderate campaign and how a breakaway group formed the more militant and notorious suffragettes. This time, we'll hear how the suffragettes' prominence is both a blessing and a curse, and how a new group, which threatens to derail the suffrage campaign, is about to gain prominence. I'm Kirsty Warg, and this is Women and Power, a podcast from the National Trust. Early in the 1900s, as the militant suffragette campaign is starting to gather pace, two powerful men, Lord Cromer and Lord Curzon, join ranks. Disgusted by these unruly and unhinged women, they set up a group to counter the suffragettes' campaign head on. Here's the National Trust Daniel Atherton, the project curator at Kedleston Hall.
Kedleston Hall is a large stately home just west of Derby, set in acres of land with livestock and birds and a beautiful lake. Kedleston was the seat of Lord Curzon, who in the early 20th century was a leading voice in the anti-suffrage campaign and vehemently attempted to block women's suffrage.
Curzon is educated at Eton and Oxford before going on to become a prominent MP and later Viceroy of India.
Curzon created an official opposition group called the Men's League for the Opposition of Women's Suffrage, and he created that alongside a number of other notable male politicians in around 1908. And the organisation then had a platform from which they could oppose suffrage at a time when the suffragettes were particularly active and the issue was really at the forefront of the national mindset.
My name is Judith Evans. I'm the house steward here at the National Trust Ostley Park and House, and this was the home of Countess Margaret Jersey. Ostley House is a beautiful 18th century neoclassical party house. We've got beautiful landscape meadows out the back and then about 360 acres of parkland, which includes a working farm. We're standing in the Long Gallery of Ostley House.
The Long Gallery is a vast room opening out onto Osterley's pleasure gardens and a prime location for parties, entertainment and gatherings of the who's who of early 20th century life.
It became really successful with the dawn of the railway station, now the Piccadilly line. It meant it opened up and meant people could easily get here in a day, have a lovely party and then go back to London to continue doing business, particularly in Parliament.
Visitors to the house around this time include MPs and statesmen, such as Earl Cromer, Controller General in Egypt, Herbert Kitchener, who becomes Secretary for War, and Neville Chamberlain, who goes on to become Prime Minister.
There's some lovely accounts of Chamberlain particularly rowing a boat on the lake with his top hat slightly askew and puffing on his pipe. So it gives you a bit of an idea of the fact it was a really great area for people to relax, come and de-stress, but also they could talk politics in a sort of safe environment with the ladies around as well. And Margaret Countess Jersey just thrived and she would start to throw these parties quite regularly and Ostley became known as a venue.
A society lady with influence and access to the upper echelons of government, Margaret Countess of Jersey is the kind of woman whose suffrage campaigners hoped would be a formidable ally.
Countess Jersey was vehemently anti-suffrage, which is a bit of a shock given her sort of social circles. She actually founded the Women's Anti-Suffrage League.
The aim of the Women's National League is to oppose women being granted the vote in parliamentary elections. However, they do support their right to vote in local government elections.
I think they felt from their manifesto and sort of from the views of Margaret Countess Jersey particularly that women's strengths lay in the local government area and also the home. So it sounds quite traditional, but they really felt their influence and everything was there.
As well as Countess of Jersey, other women who might have been expected to support the suffrage campaign instead feel the ballot box is not their place. Sophie Duncan, Junior Dean of Arts at the University of Oxford.
One woman held up by the suffragists as an example of a Victorian woman who absolutely deserved and would know how to use the vote was Octavia Hill, one of the National Trust's co-founders. Millicent Garrett-Fawcett, in a speech, compared her to Jane Austen, Florence Nightingale, great women of the 19th century who were role models for the new generation. But although Octavia Hill worked very much in the public eye, was concerned about social reform, about protecting the environment, was one of the best-known women of her day, she absolutely did not want the vote herself. Octavia Hill is so averse, she says, to having anything to do with politics that she hates even having to be as political as saying she doesn't want the vote.
The Women's Anti-Suffrage League has much graver concerns about what might happen to society if women are allowed the vote.
The words anarchy, revolution and socialism were thrown up a lot, and that was their real fear.
Such views are echoed by Lord Curzon and his Anti-Suffrage League. Daniel Atherton again.
He was one of many people who felt that such a change would be dangerous to society.
These perceived dangers were clearly outlined by Curzon in a pamphlet called 15 Good Reasons Against the Grant for Female Suffrage.
The 15 Reasons pamphlet that Curzon created was first shared after a debate in Glasgow. Today, it doesn't make for good reading. Some of the things that he was saying really cut to the core of the argument, which saw women as incapable of being politically active.
Arguments in the pamphlet range from
political activity will tend to take away woman from her proper sphere and highest duty, which is maternity,
to the suggestion that
it will tend, by the divisions which it will introduce, to break up the harmony of the home.
But probably the most controversial reason of all was
women have not, as a sex or a class, the calmness of temperament or the balance of mind, nor have they the training necessary to qualify them to exercise a weighty judgment in political affairs.
The main argument behind the 15 Reasons was that the spheres of men and women were utterly different and that women didn't have the temperament to be able to vote, particularly on issues that related to international politics. The argument went that if a woman didn't serve as a policeman or as a soldier, then why should she be able to vote on acts of law or war?
These views from an elite group of male politicians, of course, anger many.
The organisation was hampered by its status as being an exclusive organisation for men, and they recognised that limitation.
While attending one of the Countess of Jersey's famous society parties, Lord Curzon hatches a plan that would strengthen the anti-suffrage movement. Judith Evans again, from Austerley House.
In 1910, the Anti-Suffrage League and the Men's National League Against Women's Suffrage became one. They conjoined.
Together, they form a new group called the National League for Opposing Women's Suffrage, sometimes referred to simply as the National League.
Lord Curzon eventually becomes the president, and Countess Jersey takes on the vice president roles. They became very formidable allies, and she brought along all the 104 supporter groups from the Women's Anti-Suffrage League, and they joined up together. And with Lord Curzon on side, obviously, he had access to Parliament, so therefore could lobby for their sort of manifesto and what they were pushing and put their point across. And they did gain quite a lot of support. They really did work well together, and of course, Lady Jersey was a well-known figure and had a lot of influence, and a lot of people respected her.
While in London, Lord Curzon and Countess of Jersey worked together to oppose votes for women, in the West Midlands, another power couple by the names of Geoffrey and Florence Mander are working just as hard to further the suffrage cause.
I'm Hannah Squire, a conservation assistant at Whitett Manor in Wolverhampton, the home of the Mander family. It's a large middle-class Victorian home. It's a sort of Victorian, over-the-top, so much character, so much quality in the building. It really does arrest the eye. The Mander family made their money in paint. They were really radical free thinkers, and they really believed in their workers' rights and also in women's rights. Geoffrey Mander, as an MP, brought in the idea of a 40-hour working week and minimum wage to his company. They also had a free library for all their workers. So, yeah, they were very, very forward-thinking in their views.
The Manders have been a liberal-leaning family since the time of Geoffrey's grandfather, Samuel Small Mander. Samuel was the founder of Mander Brothers, a print and ink company that first brings money into the Mander family and allows them to build Whitett Manor.
In 1875, Samuel Small Mander, whose son Theodore built Whitett, and really early in the fight for women's rights, chaired a meeting in Wolverhampton where Lydia Becker spoke in favour of women's suffrage. So Lydia Becker was a really important early part of the women's suffrage movement. He thought that an improvement might follow if women were allowed to speak in Parliament. So it shows that really early on in the 1870s, Samuel Small Mander really believed that women deserved a stronger voice in society. And that really then carried on through the generations to his son Theodore and then finally to Geoffrey Mander.
Geoffrey and his wife Florence are so supportive of the suffrage movement that they use rooms within Whitett Manor to host suffrage meetings.
So we're walking now down towards our drawing room, and it's in this room where our suffrage meetings took place. In 1913, the Wolverhampton Women's Suffrage Society reports show these things called drawing room meetings, where they'd invite lecturers to come and speak. And Mrs. Archibald Little came to speak here. So Mrs. Archibald Little was a writer and an activist and a lecturer around the world, but she spent a lot of time in China with her husband. And this talk she gave was entitled The Position of Women in the East and the West. So as these ideas were being circulated in here with this local society, it was presided over by Florence Mander, and Geoffrey Mander was also part of the meeting. So these discussions talking about different societies around the world's treatment of women. This was something we only found out about 6 months ago, so it's all new information. We had no idea this is what our drawing room was used for, but we've set it up to resemble what we think this drawing room meeting might have been. And this is also a room where we give introductions, so we kind of are trying to use it as a space to have discussions and debates and talks. So we want to continue in that Mander tradition of how this room was used.
Around the country, men and women like Geoffrey and Florence are giving their time, the use of their properties and financial support to Millicent Fawcett's non-militant suffragist movement. However, it is Emmeline Pankhurst's militant suffragettes that capture the imagination of the public and the press. This, combined with the power and influence of Countess of Jersey and Lord Curzon's National League, means that the suffragists are fast becoming the forgotten campaigners. Oxford's Sophie Duncan again.
It distorts the actual impression of the movement because the suffragettes were always a minority. And that's something the suffragists really worry about. In fact, increasingly, when suffragists do demonstrate, they are mistaken for suffragettes. They're so identified in the public mind. For example, there's a protest in Oxford in early 1913.
Come on, girls, come on.
It's a torchlit procession through the centre of Oxford, by the suffragists, so it's emphatically non-violent, but the locals and the male students mistake them for suffragettes and throw stones at them.
The suffragettes' successful branding and public relations means that today, the differences between the groups are often unappreciated. For instance, the suffragists were tens of thousands of members strong, whereas the suffragettes only had 5,000 members. The differences are even as far-reaching as the iconic purple, white and green colours that are generally associated with the suffrage movement. Hannah Squire of Whitett Manor.
One of the main differences people aren't aware of is there are different colours for the suffragettes and the suffragists. So when people come to Whitett and they see our suffragist banners, they say, oh, why are they green, white and red? Why are they not green, purple and white? So the suffragettes were green, purple and white. So the white represent purity, the green for hope and the purple for sort of majesty. And the red, green and white of the suffragists is meant to represent the Italian flag. The suffragists were very much inspired by the 19th century unification of Italy. So when all the states were brought together to form one nation. So the suffragists were trying to follow in that ethos and bring everyone together united to fight for women's rights.
And the idea of unification was the catalyst for a plan that Millicent Fawcett hopes will once again bring the suffragists wider attention, the suffragist pilgrimage of 1913. Here's Sophie Duncan.
The NUWSS pilgrimage of 1913 was intended as a mass peaceful gesture to show the weight and the expanse of the peaceful suffrage movement.
The pilgrimage begins on the 18th of June. Women set off from points across the country, from as far north as Northumberland, Carlisle and Manchester, to Pontypridd in South Wales, and down to St Austell in Cornwall. Eight main routes snake towards London, and as the women march defiantly through the British Isles, they pass through or by many National Trust places. They march across Thomas Telford's famous Conway Suspension Bridge and in the shadow of the majestic Penryn Castle in Gwynedd in North Wales. They march past the splendour of Fountains Abbey in Harrogate in North Yorkshire and through the beautiful landscape of the Fowey Estuary in Cornwall. Many trust properties are also used as overnight stopping points, including the Assembly Rooms in Bath and West Wickham Village in Buckinghamshire. Upon reaching Wolverhampton, they're met by Geoffrey and Florence Mander, the owners of Whittick Manor. Here's Hannah Squire.
Both Geoffrey and Florence help preside over the meeting and provide refreshments. There are lots of talks in the centre of Hampton, and it was considered at the time the largest meeting gathering in the marketplace that they'd known in living memory.
After almost 6 weeks of marching, on the 26th of July, 50,000 women descend upon London's Hyde Park in one of the biggest spectacles of female unity the country has ever seen.
When they got to Hyde Park, there would have been a high. There was a huge emotional charge about the vote. It was the biggest.
As Millicent Fawcett takes to the stage, she and her suffragists have finally emerged from the shadow of the suffragettes. And at this moment, the attention of the public and the press is firmly fixed on their peaceful message.
Come together to have our votes for women!
Next time on Women and Power, conflict between the suffragettes and the authorities escalates to breaking point. But at the 11th hour, a truce is brought on by a catastrophic event. Women and Power is more than just this podcast. To celebrate the centenary of the Representation of the People Act, the National Trust is running a year-long programme of talks, exhibitions and installations, as well as publishing guidebooks and online articles. To learn more about the National Trust's Women and Power programme, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/womenandpower. And to learn more about the Trust locations featured in this episode, type Kedleston, Austerley House or Whittick Manor into the search bar of our website, nationaltrust.org.uk. Make sure you don't miss next week's episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find great audio. While you're there, you might also enjoy episodes of the National Trust flagship audio programme, the National Trust Podcast. To find out more about podcasts at the Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts.